Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Special edition of Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Today's episode is our Joe Strummer Day special, highlighting the issues of poverty and homelessness. In this segment of our show, Sean Wiltshire will be sharing his insights on the issues of poverty and disability. So, in previous interviews like this one, you've talked about the impact that poverty can have on disability and vice versa. So, I'd imagine this year that's played out a lot more, and with the rise in cases, may play out even further.
It definitely will. I mean, we continue to see opportunity, but we continue to see one of the biggest challenges through the pandemic had to be income support. So what was really interesting, I think, Cam, is throughout the country, people recognized, or the government recognized, that $2,000 a month was a level of income that the majority of Canadians would need to keep mind and body in hold. What was interesting is that a lot of the disability support programs across the country pay way less than that, and in some cases $700 or $800 less than that. So I think it also highlighted one of the very important issues, which was maybe looking at guaranteed income and being able to have an idea that the, you know, your value in society isn't just limited to what number of hours of support you may require or a cost. You are considered a contributing individual and you're supported that way.
So in that sense, with this guaranteed income and the provision of that, would seem to finally be at least reducing, if not breaking, the cycle of homelessness, poverty, some of the issues that would go with that.
Well, it's almost impossible because the services are so spread so thin, and the requirement of you know, we so much base services based on telling people what they need. And what we really need to do is reverse the equation and start asking people what they want. Support to go to work in the form of childcare that would allow an individual to be able to work a full day versus worrying about what will happen to the kids at 3 o'clock. That smaller cost of childcare is a much, much more investment in the community that parent can then go to work. You know, we look at this as an all or nothing equation, and it's not that. We have to look at the contribution that people make overall. We need to support people in deciding what they want, building around all of those needs. And the labor market tells us that. We've seen the continued labor shortages in the country in all sorts of industries. Never mind service industry, finance, community agencies, government. We are continuing to see a shrinking of the labor force that is going to cause continued inflation. So costs are going to continue to increase. So all of these factors have highlighted a number of very specific issues for folks with disabilities that I think give us an opportunity to say, excuse me, we need to address some of these inequities that before haven't been so clearly defined. And when one level of government says, this is a reasonable amount of money to live, and then all of the other provincial governments say, well, we're paying way less than that. That identifies a serious flaw in the system.
So That way, with the continued inflation, isn't there a risk that if the income support doesn't match it, that for someone who has to pay, say, for a specialized diet on account of their disability, they'd find themselves still in the poverty line, no matter what supports would be, because costs are continuing to mount up on them?
It is. And we have to, while we need broad programs, we also need individualized approach. You know, I've been working in employment for nearly 30 years, and I've never yet seen a corporate program that says, let's hire 5,000 people with disabilities ever work. Because the vision of it and the implementation of it are two different things. And what we're talking about here is giving, you know, the opportunity for one person to go to work, two people, three, four. You know, I always say to people, this is a building process. I often get asked the question, Cam, when will disability be normal in work? And I go, when you see somebody and you don't think anything of it. That's not a person with a disability, that's Frank. Frank works in finance. That's not a person with a disability, that's Mary. And that only comes from that inclusionary processes that a lot of businesses struggle with. Let's not forget that the majority of businesses in Canada are small to medium-sized enterprises. They don't have a HR department. They don't have, they often struggle sometimes with human resources policy. They're worried about their organization as an entity. And as we've always said, businesses are in business to make money, not so much to employ people. So we've got to change the equation. We've got to give the employer what they want, which is a skilled individual. The fact that they may live on the autism spectrum or have Down syndrome or go to work in a specialized van is really fairly irrelevant if we can match the skill and get the employer to understand that their business's bottom line can be affected by the labor pool. So all hands on deck. And the inclusionary processes that make businesses profitable include folks with disabilities.
So do you think that part of the whole mindset issue doesn't just come from the employer, but sometimes the employee, the idea that they get told they can't do this and get locked into that precept? And if so, how do we get away from that?
I think that comes down to skills matching and identifying those skills and hidden skills that folks have that aren't always present in maybe an interview or a resume. And I think that giving an opportunity to have somebody, you know, talk a little bit more about their skill set versus just a snapshot. I think that this has to do with the intake process that many companies have built to get resumes or to find candidates. They screen folks out, not by design, but by default. And maybe it's not an accessible website. Maybe the language could be confusing. Maybe the application process itself doesn't allow for people to identify other skill sets other than education or professional designation. So those processes are those things that we have to change one company at a time, and building those processes. I mean, we do get some help from government with new accessibility legislation. It brings it to the forefront. It allows people to see it as an issue beyond disability, and it's one of accessibility. And I think that those conversations are also important, because we don't want people building a ramp for folks in wheelchairs. We want people building a sloped step so everybody can make sure that they're safe walking or have access to the service. So we don't want it to be about one particular community. We want it to be about the business, the individual, and that value proposition that they have when they're, you know, the exchange of skills for money. And it's about the skill. And I think that's what's also changing, is folks are more aware of their value in our society because they grew up in a community. And I had a conversation recently, Cam, with somebody around how folks are more aware of their rights and their responsibilities and their contributions and how valuable they can be.
So in that sense, if a person recognizes their value, odds are they'd be more inclined to work in a place and an environment where they'd be treated equally, equal pay, equal challenges in terms of the work itself, I'd imagine.
And an equal benefit of, you know, the good, the bad, and the indifferent. We're seeing more and more the diversification of a labor force just by the necessity of it. But some of those things are challenges. And, you know, we always say change is messy. It is, because we're introducing folks who typically may have not been included in the workplace. And that, you know, I'll give you an example. Somebody who lives on the autism spectrum may have some difficulty negotiating the social nuances of work, and they can totally do the work. They're laser focused. They're the best person that, you know, in finance for finding, you know, the particular thing they're hired for. But they really struggle with that social piece of the interactions. They're there to do the job. Well, if you can share with people that I'm really good at my job and I struggle sometimes with social interactions, people will approach it differently. It's the same as making sure that the office is not only accessible, but if you have a lunchroom, there's always one place pulled out so that if somebody's in a wheelchair, that there's enough space if somebody had a service animal. It's just giving those smaller considerations to what we didn't think of before. And they're more inclusive, and, you know, we don't know how great the employee is until we give them an opportunity to shine.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
I will.
In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Laura Katari from the Hamilton Roundtable for Poverty Reduction. So, through the work of the Roundtable, I'd imagine you've seen a lot of issues as to how poverty and disability interact.
Indeed I have. From a lot of different angles, everything from how people end up in this situation, how the system makes it worse, and what the cost of those two things are in the lives of people with disability.
So for someone who receives, say, a disability support and is living on a fixed income, some of the medical expenses could be so exorbitant that it makes it sort of a losing proposition anyway, I would imagine.
For some people, that can be true. Be fully transparent in this interview, I am an ODSP recipient myself. I work part-time for the Roundtable. And at a certain point, the cost of my medical bills, especially prescriptions in my case, would not make it worth my while to work more. Not that I can. I'm limited by my disability, but there is a point where, you know, access to prescription benefits and other medical benefits, everything from colostomy supplies, wheelchair maintenance, things like that, that once people are off the system, they might not be earning enough to pay a $1,000 wheelchair repair bill.
So, do you find that there are a lot of myths or misperceptions about someone with a disability in a poverty situation?
Many. I think my tongue-in-cheek favorite myth is that it's so much easier living off of Ontario Disability Support Program, which is $1,169 per month, than going out and working full-time. I myself became disabled, and I was already working half-time when I lost my job. And I'll tell you, $45,000 a year is a lot easier and at the time, it was less than $10,000 a year for ODSP. We're going almost 20 years back here. So to be told that it's easier to live off of disability is not true. I live in Hamilton, Ontario, and right now, one-bedroom apartments, it depends who you look at, but they're looking at $1,100 a month for a modest one-bedroom. When it's $1,169 a month, you know people are going to have trouble eating. So no, it's not easier. And the other myth is it's easy to game the system and pretend that you're disabled. I've been through both CPP disability and the ODSP process. And I can tell you, they scrutinize every document from every specialist, every report, every test. It is not easy to game the system. There are very few doctors out there that are willing to lose their medical license by lying. And two, we go back to one. Why would someone want to live on $1,169 a month is beyond me.
So, do you find that when it comes to things like mental health and addiction, those disabilities, that it's harder to actually gain any traction in society, any status, and therefore access to the services needed?
So, I'll separate the two. Yes, gaining access to services needed is very difficult, even with the group sessions this government is currently brought on. I've spoken to many who have said, you know, that the online therapy just does not cut it. It's very much a band-aid, and they're still waiting for one-on-one therapy. I was part of a group that wrote a report for the previous government called Income Security Roadmap for Change. And one of the things we talked about was the necessity for adequate wraparound supports. So for mental health, it's not only getting direct support when you need it, when you're having a mental health crisis, but it's having the supports available for chronic and episodic illness. So with mental health, that would mean, you know, health and income security and the supports in the community all work need to work in tandem. With addictions, you add another layer to that, and I would call those intensive supports. So yes, you need wraparounds, and you need it intensive until they can make it through the process. If someone's become homeless, dropping them into an apartment is not enough. You need to have those supports, especially in the beginning, even just daily contact. You know, I'm not talking medical supports. I mean ensuring that people have contact with others, that if they run into problems with neighbors or what have you, there's someone that helps them navigate the difference, especially if someone's been homeless.
If you could send any message to the community about what needs to happen, what supports need to be in place, and how we can best serve this population, what would you say?
I think ensuring, one, that you're down literally at the ground level, developing relationships is important. The more, I'm going to use the word marginalized, anyone is, the more misunderstood they feel, the more we probably do misunderstand them. And those frontline individuals who are not there just to sign them up for a program, but are actually there to find out what the problems have been, where they'd like to go, developing trust is the first thing. Two, I want to make sure they understand that, yes, people are out, especially encampments, which have been huge in the news. They're out there because what they're being offered does not suit their needs. And we need to understand that. We're not going to move forward with these battles until we understand that we need alternate shelter housing options. We need some for couples. We need some for people who are deep in mental health issues that have been kicked out of shelters that are not allowed back in. We need to recognize that and become creative. Constantly criminalizing them for sleeping in the rough in places you don't like is not going to cure that.
I'd thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure can.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
In a classroom, in residence, or online, Sexual violence is prevalent across campuses, yet many survivors remain silent. If you have experienced sexual violence, it's important to know that it was not your fault and you are not alone. The University of Windsor has partnered with Reese to make online reporting available for students and staff who are a part of the campus community. You can create an anonymous report or access information and resources 24/7. Reese gives you the option to document and report harassment, misconduct, or assault in whatever way you choose. Visit reescommunity.com to learn more. Reese, respect, educate, and empower survivors at reescommunity.com.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Sean Wiltshire about the issues of poverty and disability. And Laura Katari told us a little bit about the Hamilton Roundtable. In this segment of our show, we're going to hear about Sarnia Mayor Mike Bradley's efforts to combat issues related to poverty and disability. So, in previous interviews at this time of year, you've talked a lot about some of the issues of poverty and disability. I'd imagine this has been a pretty big year for that with the pandemic and all.
Well, it certainly has, and you can add into that the addiction issue, which is linked to the two issues we just talked about, that it's been a very difficult year for a lot of people, and a complete difficult time for people trying to get through one crisis or another, whether it be emotional or mentally or financially. So that's it's been probably one of the worst years I can think of in the sense of what people have had to deal with. And unfortunately, as we come to the end of the year, it is not only there, but it's also growing expeditiously.
So, your city, Sarnia, has done a lot of work to sort of minimize the impact of these issues in previous years. Have there been any successes in recent memory towards your initiatives?
Well, you know, you do your best with limited resources. I mean, the federal and provincial governments are responsible for the homeless agenda, for the disability agenda with legislation. We have a role to play in it, but we don't have the resources. So a lot of what we do is advocacy and continuing to push for changes. I do think one of the upsides of the pandemic for people with disabilities looking for employment, the fact that working from home has now become a very key factor with employers, is of great assistance to them. And I think that's an upside that will continue.
So what's on the horizon for 2022? More work for people with disabilities in terms of the mayor's challenge?
We had a very successful Light Up the Country campaign back in a few weeks ago, which had communities from coast to coast light up to recognize disability employment. And we want to grow that next year. It's an awareness campaign, which also has the value of just educating people. And we had it from coast to coast and into the north. So I want to continue that. I think when you ask, what's ahead in the year ahead, who knows? Last year we talked, it was about, we're feeling optimistic about where we're going with COVID. We thought things were getting better. And then obviously that's not what's happened. So all you can do is keep on doing as many normal things as you can, and that includes pushing for disability employment, trying to make employers aware, and that includes government, and try to disregard what's happening in the COVID area, hoping that when we get to better days that it'll all come together.
So, in that sense, how are you going about reaching out to employers and business professionals and governments to let them know that it could be in their interest to include people with disabilities?
Well, I work closely with the Ontario Disability Employment Network, ODIN. And ODIN is an umbrella organization with a lot of other organizations connected to disability employment as its members. And that's the best vehicle that I have to work with and trying to educate people. They are very much focused on the private sector. Now I do try to keep on reminding them that the public sector is a huge employer and should not be forgotten. But that's the best way to reach so many people who are out there on the ground level trying to find employment for those with disabilities.
So if you could see anything added to the current situation to provide someone with a disability an equal opportunity, what would it be?
Well, it would be to have a guaranteed annual income for those with disabilities that aren't employable or are employable that is actually sufficient to live on. And we saw this through the CERB program, that people with disabilities were still being left behind by receiving less funds. And I'd hope that the government of Canada would recognize that and upgrade those payments substantially so people have a living wage. Whether actively employed with a disability or disabled. And that day hasn't arrived yet. I think that's going to be one of the big pushes politically in the year ahead.
So if you could send any message to those in power and to the disability community as a whole about what needs to happen, what would you say?
Well, first of all, for years I've been preaching it's a human rights issue. It's not a charity issue. It is human rights. And I think that message is starting to sink in with governments. And I think that they need to understand that there's a large number of people out there, but their human rights are not being respected by the way we treat people who are disabled and the way we employ them. So that's the message. Just don't give up hope. Keep pushing. You know, it was Winston Churchill that said, never give up, never give up, never give up. And that's the attitude I've adopted. We've come a long way. We ended the workshops that were in existence paying small wages, if at all. We've been progressive in other areas. And I just think we just keep on moving and keep on pushing. And at some point, the disability community will receive not the patronizing respect, the real respect they deserve across this country.
So are there any steps that individual members of the community can take to get beyond the myths and stereotypes that might come with poverty and disability, or just a first impression?
Well, I often hear from people in that situation, their voice doesn't matter. And my message back to them is it does matter. Let your MPP, your mayor, your MP know your situation. And let them know the solutions, and there are solutions there. When you look at the billions and billions that are being spent across this country on COVID-related programs, you know that money should also be directed into gainful employment and opportunities for those with disabilities. But the power of one voice should never be underestimated. And I think what often happens in what people consider a marginalized community, they just give up and say, what's the point? It doesn't make any difference. It's not going to change anything. And I think that's one area that the disability group needs to be much more focused on, is putting that pressure on politically, on all three levels of government to take action on their issues.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, thanks, Ken.
Of course. My friends, if you get right down to it, there are no easy answers when it comes to the issues of poverty and disability. But the fact is, a person with a disability may have to enter that situation dealing with the idea of not only the myths surrounding someone having a disability, but the myths of being in poverty. It'd be a very vicious cycle at times. But, like any situation in life, there's always hope, there's always recourse. A person might have to take difficult steps forward, finding it within themselves to ask for help in those tough times. But, as with disability life, there's no shame in asking for help in a poverty situation. Fact is, things get better when people work cooperatively. They create hope and a future. If a person feels they have to take it all on their own, it becomes a hopeless situation. And we just see the problems of it, not the potential solutions. We as a people deserve better than that. We're born into this world not knowing the dangers, the pitfalls. We're also born not knowing the potentials, the hopes, the dreams. And that too is something we should have the freedom to explore. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.